From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, practicing medicine under fire. Dr. Ronnie Brauman is the president of the French-based medical aid group Doctors Without Borders. The group sends volunteer doctors around the world wherever people are desperately in need of care because of war, famine, or natural disaster. National Public Radio reporter Deborah Amos has returned to the States after years of covering hotspots in the Middle East. Coming up, we talk about some of her experiences covering the Gulf War. And Maureen Corrigan reviews filmmaker John Sayles' new novel, Los Gusanos. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House today said that Iraq has admitted engaging in a nuclear weapons program and must be forced to submit to international inspection. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
After Iraq presented a 29-page document to the International Atomic Energy Agency detailing its nuclear program, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater offered it as proof that Iraq is trying to make nuclear weapons. Fitzwater also accused Iraq of violating, until now, Security Council resolutions which require it to identify its nuclear facilities. The spokesman said that a 37-member international inspection team is in Iraq now and that the government should allow the team to inspect suspected nuclear sites. The inspection team will make its report by the end of the week, and Fitzwater said that report will have a great bearing on further steps taken by the administration to force Iraqi compliance with the UN resolutions. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The European community is preparing to send observers to Yugoslavia to help monitor the truce between Slovenia and the federal government. The plan would provide two-person teams composed of civilians and military officers who'd work with Slovenian and Federal Army liaisons. The EC stressed that the monitors would be unarmed and would not be peacekeepers. One official said that the monitors might also operate in Croatia, where federal troops intervened yesterday in fighting between Croats and ethnic Serbians. The peace plan calls for federal soldiers to return to their barracks and for Slovenia's militia to be demobilized. Kuwait's National Assembly meets tomorrow for the first time since the country was freed from Iraqi occupation. But opposition groups raised complaints today that the interim legislature is unconstitutional. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Kuwait will pay out $25 billion for its share of the Gulf War, but there is no elected parliament or free press to discuss the huge expenditures. This was one of the complaints that Kuwait's seven opposition groups voiced at a press conference today. The dissidents are protesting the convening of a national council tomorrow, which it claims is unconstitutional. In the 4 months since liberation, opposition figures have grown increasingly vocal over the emir's slow progress in instituting democratic reforms promised during the war. The emir has set parliamentary elections for October 1992 to give the country more time to rebuild itself. The opposition says elections should be sooner. Today's gathering went off smoothly compared to rallies last year, which the police broke up with tear gas and clubs. In Kuwait City, I'm John Burnett.
Stock prices rebounded from an early decline today to finish sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 29 points to close at 2,962. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was approximately 136 million shares. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. State budget standoffs continued today in Connecticut, Maine, and Pennsylvania. State employees went back to work in Connecticut and Maine, but only under temporary funding agreements. Connecticut is operating under a stopgap measure. Its legislature was to vote today on whether to extend the measure for 2 weeks, while Governor Lowell Weicker and the lawmakers debate an income tax proposed by the governor. President Bush says the creation of hundreds of radically new kinds of schools throughout the country has begun in earnest. Today he unveiled the New American Schools Development Corporation, which will raise the money to find out what works. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
President Bush's New American Schools plan will cost at least $700 million just to get one new school started in each of the nation's 435 congressional districts, a promise he made last April. But the president today insisted that the new schools he wants will not cost more money to run than existing schools.
We don't want our New American Schools initiative to purchase bricks and mortar. We want to encourage an experiment, a competition of ideas that can bring even the oldest school building in America alive with learning.
Board members of the American Schools Development Corporation, headed by former New Jersey Governor Tom Kane, said they've raised $30 million of the $200 million necessary to take the best ideas and get communities to apply them, free of administrative red tape. Details about who'll be able to sell their ideas and who'll attend these schools are sketchy, which is why few will be ready before the 1993 school year. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
President Bush's nominee to the Supreme Court began making courtesy calls on key senators today after his name was officially submitted to the Senate. Judge Clarence Thomas was named by the president to succeed retiring Justice Thurgood Marshall. Although Thomas, like Marshall, is a black man, his conservative record has led to opposition from civil rights and women's groups. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Where there is famine, war, or natural disaster, and no proper existing medical facilities, you're likely to find the group Doctors Without Borders caring for the sick and wounded. Volunteer doctors have served in Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Africa, Romania, and Southeast Asia. Over the past 20 years, Doctors Without Borders has become the world's largest independent emergency medical aid association. It was founded in 1971 in France, where the group is known as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF. My guest, Dr. Ronnie Brauman, is the president of the group and has participated in nearly all their missions since he joined in 1978. He was just in Philadelphia to accept the Philadelphia Liberty Medal in recognition of the group's contributions to freedom and equality. The Red Cross has a code that prevents its medical workers from discussing the politics behind the wars and famines in the countries where they work. MSF was formed by doctors who had worked in the Biafran War and who wanted to speak out about how the Nigerian government had blockaded relief supplies to thousands of starving people. But Dr. Brauman says when he first heard of MSF, he wasn't sure it was an organization he'd want to join.
When MSF was created in 1971, I was a medical student. I was in my third year of medical studies. And in fact, I didn't like Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders at all because I was a leftist radical at that time. And I thought that, all the solutions were political and that bringing relief, humanitarian aid was just bringing illusion to the people. And I decided that I would try something with Médecins Sans Frontières just because it was doing something in the third world. And I wanted to know what the third world was like. You know, we thought that the revolution would come from the third world and that many things would come from the third world. So I decided to join Médecins Sans Frontières to be on the field, to be in the third world. And in order, of course, to change the third world, to achieve, you know, revolutionary goals. And in fact, the third world and my experience changed me. And I decided that, I didn't know what sort of political project I was supposed to bring to those people, but I had many things to bring to them from my profession, from my human approach, and I had many things to learn from them, just because they were what they were, their culture, their situations, were highly, extremely interesting. And on the more balanced and realistic exchange, I changed my mind and I continued.
So did you become less of a revolutionary after actually witnessing the results of revolutions in the third world?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why was that?
Well, you know, the first terrible experience was the Khmer Rouge experience in Cambodia when we discovered what it was all about. I mean, when we discovered all those mass massacres, frightening social surgery which was performed in this country, we realized what revolution could be when it was radicalized to that extent. And then, the boat people from Vietnam and then, Poland and then, what was happening in the eastern countries showed us that even when it was not that radicalized, the social effects and the liberties were absolutely tragic. So I just gave up.
You gave up on revolution, but not on helping people.
Not on helping, not on social goals, not on solidarity spirit. I think that all this is important. From this period of my life, I still have in mind that, solidarity, sharing are very important values, and I still believe in them.
Tell me what it's been like for you to learn how to perform surgery under conditions that would be considered unsanitary and unsafe in the West.
Well, first, you operate on patients who will die if you don't operate on them. The indications of surgery are much tougher in these conditions due to lack of antisepsy, to the lack of medicines. But I had a real good theater, surgical table, good surgical boxes, and I could do a rather good job. The problem is that I was both anesthesiologist and surgeon because I had no anesthetics, of course. So that complicated the work quite a deal. And, the way you can get reassured on your work is that, you know that if you don't operate on this patient, he will just die. But another problem raises now. And the problem is that when you operate in emergency on such a patient, very often it's an emergency you're not prepared to deal with. Why? Just because a patient who would come to the hospital to be operated on with, for instance, a acute abdominal syndrome, peritonitis or something like that, would be operated on straight away in a normal hospital. Now, when he comes to you, you say, okay, I'm going to treat you, you've got to be operated on. Then he says, or his relatives say, we accept the idea, but we've got to go back to the village and ask the family council to give his opinion on this proposal. So that may take another 3, 4, 5 days. And you just can't do anything before the village and the family have made a meeting, gave their opinion, and handed over to you. This is absolutely forbidden, even if the patient dies. This is very, very tough. I mean, on a psychological, on a deontological way, it's extremely difficult for us to accept that. It took me a number of weeks to accept it, but I did it. And then, when you operate, of course, a peritonitis after 5, 6, 7 days is extremely difficult to operate on. So, that changes a bit the techniques of intervention, and that complicates still more the problem. But, you have to do with that, and you learn a lot from that.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Ronnie Brauman, who's the president of Doctors Without Borders, an emergency medical aid organization which provides relief to victims of disasters, wars, and famines around the world. Were you in the Middle East during the Gulf War?
Yes, I was in Turkey and Iraq just about 6 weeks ago.
And what were you specifically doing there? What was the nature of your mission?
Well, first of all, bringing emergency medical relief to the Kurds fleeing from Iraq towards Turkey and Iran. So we had a very large team there. At one stage, we had more than 150 doctors, nurses, logistic officers, because everything was extremely complicated. The climate, it was, the late winter, it was still very cold. The geography, it's in high mountains. Politics, because, as you know, neither the Turks nor the Iranians were cheerfully welcoming those refugees, at first stage at least. And we found it very difficult to set up, all our tent hospitals and dispensaries in those conditions. So it was a real tough job, but extremely useful, because we lost time at the beginning of the crisis. But then, after a couple of weeks, it became possible to work at top speed, and we worked night and day, and I think we helped and saved many, many people.
What were the typical medical problems you were seeing when you were in Turkey or northern Iraq?
The main problems were diarrhea and respiratory infections, but severe ones, which claimed many, many lives. many, many lives. And most of the children who died, died from respiratory or diarrheal infections.
What do you do to protect yourself when you're exposed to things like this?
Nothing. Nothing. It's useless. It's useless. Those people get infected because they are very weak, they lack of, basic hygiene. We are not that weak, and we have the basic hygiene, so it's all right for us. We need nothing, except, of course, when we work in a cholera camp. Cholera camp is an isolated area where you set up tents tents where we just follow-up tents, then intensive care tents, then recovery tents. Three kinds of different tents. And this has to be very, very firmly isolated. There is a small bath where you have to step in order to disinfect your shoes. You have to spray the soles of your shoes and sometimes your jacket or your clothes in order not to spread the infection throughout the camp. That's the main thing. But I mean, we hardly had any case of cholera in our own teams. We had only two, and we've treated, probably over the past 2 years, we've treated more than 30,000 cases of cholera.
Did you have any doctors who were in Iraq during the war while Iraq was being bombed?
No. No, it was forbidden. We tried to get into Iraq, but we were not given the permission.
By the Iraqi government?
By the Iraqi government, yes.
Are you often turned down by governments?
Not often, and I would say less and less. But on the early 80s, I think we have to say the word, because I mean that's the reality. When communism was still at its peak, some countries were quite difficult to enter. I'm talking about Cambodia, Afghanistan, Angola. These kind of countries where you had to be pro-government to be admitted in the country. And we were not pro-government. We were not anti-government either. I mean, we were non-political. But being non-political in those conditions meant, to the eyes of the political leaders of those countries, be anti-government. So we were not accepted.
Dr. Brauman, let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Dr. Ronnie Brauman, who's president of Doctors Without Borders. It's an emergency medical aid organization which provides relief to victims of disasters and wars and famines around the world. It's a French-based organization, and in France it's known by the title of Médecins Sans Frontières. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Ronnie Brauman is my guest, the president of Doctors Without Borders. Have you personally ever been under attack or threatened by forces who didn't respect your role as doctor?
Oh, yes, several times, yes.
Can you give me an example of one of those times and how you handled it?
I was working in Chad with a surgical team. I was the team leader because I'd been working on the field for 3-4 years. And we had a break. And went to wash in the river, in the Shari River, which makes the border between Chad and Cameroon. And there was no water in town. There was absolutely nothing. So we had to go to the river to wash ourselves and have some water to boil and drink then. And we were caught under heavy fire by a group of unidentified people who turned out to be the opponents of the group with which we were working. And they had sent a commando of about 20 people to kill us. And it was an absolute miracle that we were not killed. I mean, the surgeon, unfortunately, was severely injured. He got two bullets. I was a bit further on with the anesthesiologist, and we were just in the river, trying to trying to dive, to be underwater, to escape from the bullets. And we had the impression that it was raining, you know, that heavy drops were falling in the in the in the water. And that lasted about 4 to 5 minutes. And all of a sudden it stopped for a reason which is not clear to my eyes up to now. And that allowed us to take the surgeon and take him to another hospital in Cameroon, where he was operated on by the French army, which was there. And we went back to Chad, and another surgeon joined us, and we resumed the work, and we paid more attention to security measures.
Did the surgeon survive?
Yes, he survived. He's okay now. Now he's in New Caledonia.
So he's still doing this kind of work?
Well, he did it again. No, he's working, I mean, as a hospital surgeon in New Caledonia, but he did the other missions afterwards.
Can you share with us a recent experience that you had that you just found profoundly moving?
I would say that the two last trips on the field were profoundly moving. One was in Turkey, where I saw what was happening in those refugee camps, and the situation was absolutely dreadful, horrible. But I think that most of our listeners know it because they've seen it on their TV screens, and I think they've been moved as much as I have. The other situation, which is almost as appalling, is in Mozambique in southern Africa. In this country, which doesn't bring a lot of media attention, doesn't bring much of public opinion or political attention, there is an old war which is going on. And this war, in the aftermath of the war, there is a large-scale famine. When I say large-scale famine, I should precise that, in fact, thousands of people are touched by the famine, are concerned by the famine, but in pouches, you know, in small areas where you can find, for instance, 10, 15, 20,000 people who are just starving to death because they just can't reach their own field. They have been forcibly relocated and almost condemned to death by starvation because, well, the logics of war is going on, and the militaries, whether guerrilla or official, again, doesn't make much difference. The militaries are waging war, and the civilian population is suffering, and is suffering to an extent which is really difficult to imagine. I'll give you an example. I was in a small village, which is called Lugela, right in the center of Mozambique. In this village, which has normally about 500 to 600 inhabitants, 18,000 people were forcibly taken, this time by the government forces. 18,000 people. After 3 months, 5,000 of them had died from starvation and cholera. 5,000 of them. That means that almost one-third of the people of this population had died in less than 3 months. That gives you an idea of the tragedy. And I think, and I'd like to seize the opportunity of talking to you and here in the States, I'd like to raise to some extent public attention on what's happening in Mozambique. There is an urgent need for media attention, for public opinion attention, and for emergency aid in this country. If there is public attention, if there is political attention, and if there is more aid, it will be easier to reach those who need to be reached, those people who are isolated and forcibly relocated, and we will be able to save them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ronnie Brauman. He's president of Doctors Without Borders, which is an emergency medical aid organization which provides relief to victims of disasters, wars, and famines around the world. Do you still find, in spite of all the years that you've been doing this kind of medical relief work, do you still find that there are medical problems and wounds that you are just unprepared for?
When I was in Sri Lanka recently, I saw a young girl. You were talking about moving situation. That was another moving situation, to see a child who is wounded. This is probably the... I mean, you just can't get used to that. Never. This poor child, I mean, it was an 11 years girl. had got several shrapnels on her left shoulder. And, well, the shoulder was just blown off. And, I mean, there was nothing much we could do for her. And that was absolutely horrible. But I doubt that we could have done something really more efficient in Paris or New York. Because there was no more shoulder anyway.
When you come back from the field, back to your home in Paris, does Western medicine seem any different to you? High-tech medicine, the things that we can afford, those of us who are lucky enough to be able to afford it or have health insurance.
Yes. I must say that sometimes, yes. First of all, I think that sometimes the doctors, and probably the patient, this is probably the whole society, everybody seems to forget that, there is an end to our lives. And death and disease seem to become a real scandal in our societies. And that surprises me. I think that disease has to be treated, but disease is not a scandal. Disease is part of the life. And, death is part of the life. I mean, death is the normal. There wouldn't be any life if there was no death. And I am surprised to see that it seems to be more and more unacceptable in our societies. And I think that this has a very bad influence on the medical techniques, on the medical corps, because it sounds like we should have doctors to look after all the everything we do, the way we eat, the way we move, the way we drive, the way we sleep. And I think this is quite insane. And this is more and more surprising for me.
I guess it must be odd for you to go from one situation where thousands of people are dying from famine to another situation where incredibly heroic measures and expensive measures are used to save one person's life.
Yeah, well, I think that this is also, I mean, part of the honor of developed societies. I think that to spend a lot of money, a lot of energy to save one life is not questionable in one sense. My question is rather about, well, the way we would like to medicalize all the aspects of our lives.
Do you ever worry that having been exposed to as much tragedy as you have, that your heart will be hardened to it?
Yes and no. I mean, you have to protect yourself. I've been doing this kind of job for about 15 years. And honestly, if I had the same reactions today as those I had 15 years ago, I just would be depressed. I mean, I just couldn't carry on. But to protect yourself doesn't mean that you become indifferent. I told you, there is one thing you can never be used to, you can never get used to. It's the suffering, the suffering of a child. And unfortunately, this is the main problem, this is the main situation we are faced with. And against this, I am not, and I don't want, in fact, to be protected.
Dr. Brauman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Dr. Ronnie Brauman is the president of Doctors Without Borders. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. NPR's Deborah Amos has covered the war in the Gulf, the Iran-Iraq war, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. You've heard her reports on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. After about 10 years of covering hotspots, Deborah Amos has returned to the States for a one-year leave of absence. Coming up, Amos reflects on her experiences covering the war in the Gulf. And John Sayles, the director of the films The Return of the Sakaka Seven, The Brother from Another Planet, Meet One, and Eight Men Out, has a new novel, and Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Leaders in Yugoslavia have expressed hope that a peace plan brokered by the European Community might help their country avert civil warfare. The agreement lays out a formula by which Slovenia might peacefully gain its independence from Yugoslavia. But as NPR's Tom Gelton reports, there are many problems still to overcome.
Under the accord negotiated over the weekend, the republics of Croatia and Slovenia both agree to hold off on further moves toward independence for the next 3 months. Slovenia agrees to share responsibility for administering its international borders with the federal Yugoslav government, and Yugoslav army troops are supposed to move back into their barracks and stay there. It took all day yesterday and much of the night to reach the agreement, and much remains to be negotiated. Slovenia and the federal government, for example, must work out a detailed procedure for their separation. Slovenia agrees not to take any more unilateral steps, at least for the time being. Meanwhile, the most difficult and dangerous problem in Yugoslavia, the conflict between the republics of Serbia and Croatia, is barely touched in this agreement. Croatian officials say the Yugoslav army should withdraw from Croatian as well as Slovenian territory, but there are no signs yet the army is willing to do so. I'm Tom Gelton in Zagreb.
Officials of the International Atomic Energy Agency say Iraq has given details of what was termed an extensive nuclear program. The agency said Iraq had produced half a kilogram of slightly enriched material during testing. Under a UN ceasefire resolution ending the Persian Gulf War, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein promised to cooperate with the UN in identifying and destroying all nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons material and some long-range ballistic missiles. On Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell has accused President Bush of resorting to racial hiring quotas in his nomination of federal Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senator Mitchell told reporters today that President Bush is guilty of the very thing he says he's against.
President Bush has made many speeches saying that he's against quotas, but it is now obvious that he's against quotas for everyone but himself at all positions but the Supreme Court.
Mitchell says he does not accept the president's statement that race was not a factor at all in the nomination. Mitchell says it's not a criticism of Thomas or of diversity on the court. And he says he said as much to Judge Thomas when he met with him today at the Capitol. Confirmation hearings in the Senate are expected to begin in September, but so far no date has been set. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 29 points to close at 2,961 in light trading. This is NPR News. According to the National League of Cities, 6 out of 10 U.S. cities will face a budget deficit this year. The league also predicts that a quarter of all U.S. cities will run into the same problems that led Bridgeport, Connecticut, to file for bankruptcy last month. Officials say that there are two reasons for these problems. One, a sharp economic downturn that cut into tax revenues and pushed up spending on unemployment and other services. And secondly, a steady drop in federal aid over the last 10 years. President Bush has endorsed a plan for driving down housing expenses by trimming state and local regulations governing the construction of new homes. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The report issued by the Department of Housing and Urban Development says the federal government should use financial incentives to pressure states and local communities to trim or eliminate regulations governing zoning, environmental protection, rent control, and labor costs. Those regulations, says the report, increase the price of a new home between 20% to 30%.
We've got to confront this problem of regulation and excessive red tape the bureaucracy in times interfering, and these are obstacles that make it difficult to construct housing for low-income families.
But critics of the report say eliminating regulations will do little to stimulate the construction of low-income housing. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Also in Washington, State Department officials said today that Israel should give up its security zone inside Lebanon and let the Lebanese army take over the region. Yesterday, the Israeli defense minister said control over the area was vital to Israeli security. The State Department says that it's been encouraged by the progress that the Lebanese government has made in extending its authority into southern Lebanon. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For about 10 years, we've heard NPR's Deborah Amos reporting on conflicts around the world. She covered the war in the Gulf, the Iran-Iraq war, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the crackdown in Tiananmen Square. Long before the Gulf War, Amos deepened our understanding of the Middle East through her astute political coverage and her moving stories of men, women, and children living there. Now Amos has returned to the States for a one-year leave of absence. She will be a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and has already begun work on a book. Today and tomorrow, we'll be talking about some of her experiences covering the Middle East. First, I wanted to know why she decided to take a leave of absence.
You know, it came because one morning I woke up and I couldn't remember whether the Soviets had withdrawn from Afghanistan first or the Palestinian uprising had started first. And it woke me up and I couldn't remember. I just couldn't put the sequence of events together. And I thought, okay, this has been too much. You really need to stop for a while. And so I decided in February to apply for a fellowship. I was fairly desperate by February. It was after the air war had started, and I knew that I was close to burnout, that I just needed a break. And I could make it through when I knew that I was going to get a break.
How often did the urge to get a real break come in the previous years?
Not very often. It was incredibly exciting, and it never stopped. I had a job that was classified as a fireman, and I used to call myself a news Bedouin. Instead of having a beat where you had the ebb and flow of a situation, I went to the hot spot. So it never stopped. And while you would get tired, it was so incredibly exhilarating and exciting. It was really hard to imagine giving it up, although that came to an end in the Gulf War. That was so compelling, so overwhelming and overpowering, that I frankly knew it was time to take a break and just think about it.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, reporting during the war. You have to report under the pool restrictions and the other press restrictions. Now that the war, you know, has been over for a while, and you've had a chance to really reflect on those restrictions, where do you stand on them? How much do you think that they were harmful? Do you think that they served an important function?
I've had two major thoughts about the restrictions. I do think that they were harmful. I think what they did was dilute the coverage. There were no high moments. There were no low moments, but there were no high moments. I think at some moment towards the end, the military saw us as the historians, and they had blown the chance. There were not enough of us in the places that we should have been if we really were the historians of this battle. And I think that they kept a lot of information away from us that was not detrimental to their warfighting capabilities. But I'll say something else that I've really thought about a lot since the war, and that is, you know, it's always said that generals fight the last war, but I think in this case, reporters were reporting on the last war while the military was fighting a war of the 1990s. I don't think that we understood what was happening, because most of us aren't Pentagon correspondents. And even those of us who are tend to focus our coverage on congressional hearings where a helicopter doesn't work or a tank doesn't work or they spent too much on a toilet seat. And so the really important concepts, military concepts, that were being tested out here, we didn't understand and we didn't report on them. The whole sense of a new military doctrine that was introduced in the late 80s, I don't think we understood about the military buildup to this war, the 10 years since the Carter Doctrine said that we would defend the oil fields militarily if anyone tried to take them over. We didn't understand military policy directed towards Iraq in the last year. And so while the restrictions were loathsome, and I think that people in higher positions than mine should battle this one out with the military, I think that there's also a problem on the journalist side about what we knew and what we were reporting about.
Did you ever violate any of the Pentagon press restrictions?
Yes.
Can you tell us how?
Early on in January, there was an Iraqi attack on the Saudi city of Khafji. Now, the reason that we found out about it is because a wire service called from Bahrain, called the hotel in Khafji and got Iraqis on the line. And that's how we knew that the town had been attacked. So the pool system was a bust. It didn't work. The military waited for more than 12 hours to tell us about it. And we were furious. And we went to the commanders who ran the Joint Information Bureau in Dahran and said we wanted to go. And we were all on, pools. And this was the whole point of the pool system. And they called the Marine commander up there. And he said, no, we've got enough people up here. There were journalist pools up there. They didn't have a clue what was going on. And so a group of us, there were six of us, decided that we would get in a car. We wore our best military fatigues. As a British colleague of mine said, you had to look rufty-tufty. You looked a little dirty, and you threw some dirt on the side of your four-wheel Jeep, and we evaded all of the Saudi roadblocks, and we got about 5 kilometers outside of Khafji. Now, we stopped on the side of the road, and a Marine colonel gave us an on-the-record interview for 45 minutes, and what we found out was that part of the reason the battle was taking so long is there was a Marine reconnaissance unit inside the city. So they couldn't do a whole lot until they got those guys out of there. Now, nobody knew about this. So, yes, I broke the rules. I got a good story out of it. I didn't risk anybody's security. It was the only time I did, because very shortly after that, the air war and then the ground war started, and there was really no time to do that kind of thing. And there wouldn't have been a good reason to do it, because to find out, to break the rules, you would have had to drive into Iraq. And one of our colleagues had done that, and we knew what happened to him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Amos, and she's been with NPR for many years. She's on a one-year leave now. She covered the war mostly from Dahran, and also she was in Kuwait just right after it was liberated. She's been reporting from the Middle East for about 10 years. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. NPR reporter Deborah Amos is my guest. She's on a one-year leave from NPR after covering the world's hotspots, especially in the Middle East, for many years. What was the military's conception of National Public Radio, and did that affect the access that you got?
Yeah, it did. It was great. The military listens to us, the Air Force in particular, and the Marines, because they get it on Armed Forces Radio.
Oh, and all things considered, or all things considered in Morning Edition?
All of it. And so, in fact, a lot of people knew who I was. And it made access excellent. I spent an entire day with the head of the Marine Corps in Saudi Arabia, Walter Boomer, who let me do that because he's a public radio listener. And I would be out. There was what's called a force-on-force exercise, and that means a bunch of tanks rolling around. And the other colonels kept saying, who is that? And General Boomer would say, that's Deborah Amos. I've always been a big fan of National Public Radio. It was amazing. And it also happened after the air war, much to the dismay, I can assure you, of my commercial colleagues who brought the matter up with Pete Williams. They said that we were the same as the Tobacco Times, and the reason that the military was dealing with us is because we were real easy on them. I mean, it simply wasn't true, but there was some jealousy over the fact that we did have, I think, better access than our commercial colleagues. And I was very, very pleased by that, that the military does listen to us.
That's really interesting. Was there ever information you had during the war that you didn't want to report for ethical reasons, that you thought that this information was true, but that it might endanger the troops?
No, the only time, of course, is at the beginning of the ground war, where I did know everything that was happening. I could see it on the map. Now, I was in contact with...
What do you mean you knew everything?
I could see it on the map. I knew about the left hook, the surprise left hook, where we had forces that went into the western desert of Iraq.
You saw it on the military map?
I saw it on the intelligence maps.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and I knew that. Now, every day, I could get on the telephone and talk to Neil Conan, who was our correspondent in Dahran. And I couldn't say what I knew. He was still reporting. He was reporting off the briefings that were coming out of Riyadh. And I had to be very careful about what I said, because I did know, and it was too early to really report that. So, yes, I think that would, I guess, be in the category of a time where I didn't say.
If you could have given him information without going on the telephone, would you have let him know?
Yeah. But there was no way to do it. What I wanted him to do was ask me questions, because he would say, gosh, I can't figure out why such and such is happening. And I would say, I know.
Right.
But it was, the situation was such that it never occurred to him that I would know. And there was no way I could say, Neil, I've seen it on the maps. I've been in the intelligence room. I've seen everything. So maybe it was just as well that there was only one of us who had to really, you know, make those decisions about, no, I can't report that.
And you would have wanted to give him the information not so that he could have reported it, but so that he could have been there and seen what was happening?
Well, so he could have understood what was going on.
Right.
Because, look, we knew that we were in a process where we were going to be reporting the end of this war for the next couple of months. The faster you understood what the strategy was, the easier it would be for you to figure out what kind of questions to be asking.
Right.
I mean, Neil is a responsible journalist. He would know better than to say, they're all sneaking up the west side and they're going into Iraq. The point was to tell him what the strategy was so you could make some intelligent guesses on what was happening and you could judge independently. You see, that was what was so difficult. We were so dependent on the military to give us our judgments. Was it going okay? Was it fast enough? Were the troops fighting well? How did we know? Because our information was all controlled by the military if you were outside the pool system. I was on the inside, and I could see everything.
Deb, why did they let you see these intelligence maps in the first place?
Because I think that they knew that they had control of us. We were in the pool, so they could monitor all of our reporting, and they could stop us giving out the secrets. On the other hand, they also were sophisticated enough to understand that we did need to know that. We were going to be reporting on this war for months to come. We might as well know what happened. You know, it was important for us to know exactly what happened.
What was the most difficult time you had getting to a phone to file during the war?
Kuwait City. Kuwait City was a nightmare, and Kuwait City changed the rules of reporting. The game used to be that you had to get there first. Now you have to get there first, and you have to get to a telephone. And if you didn't bring one with you, there weren't any in Kuwait City. Now, on the first day, I drove up from King Khalid Military City and into western Kuwait. I stopped at a place called the Ali Salam Air Base. And there, the Saudi 20th Brigade was there, and there were some Americans there. And the place had been, quote, liberated about 12 hours earlier. I had come up the desert in an incredible drive, seeing, you know, shattered tanks, seeing the Iraqi oil trenches. Now, what was I going to do with that information? There were no telephones. Lo and behold, the BBC shows up, and a colleague of mine, Brian Barron, says, do you want to use the phone? So I could call out on that first morning simply because I ran into him. And we made our phone calls in the front seat of a four-wheel drive, and I could call into London, and London could relay that information back to Washington. I hit Kuwait City, same problem. The city was incredible, but there was no way to report it. So this time it was the BBC again who did have a satellite phone, and I spent that first day out in front of the British Embassy waiting in line to first get on Sky Television's phone and then to get on the BBC. And every day it was the same story. You could get the story. It was what the military would call a story-rich environment. The problem was the telephone.
What was the riskiest situation that you were in during the war? Where you felt the most physically in danger?
You know, it's very interesting. There was only one time throughout the entire war that I felt myself in physical danger, and that was the first night of the air war. And I had gone downstairs to make a broadcast when we knew that the air war had started. And at some moment, the alarms went off in the hotel. And I ran back up to the room to get my gas mask, and we all piled down into the basement. And we got through the first one, and that was all right. And then we had about a 20-minute break where everybody came back upstairs. The telephones weren't back on again, and the alarms went off again. These were very loud alarms that went out all the way through the hotel. This time I was a little smarter than the last time. This time I brought a radio with me because I didn't know how long we'd be down there. And so we trooped back down into the cellar. I was in, you know, my chemical mask, and I had my radio. And I remember that Armed Forces Radio was broadcasting ABC news, and I heard Peter Jennings say that Israel had been hit by a chemical weapon. And somehow, in my mind, it was like the end of the world. It was the worst thing I could think of. And what my fright was about is that I didn't know what was going to happen next. Now, within an hour, we knew that that wasn't true. And from that moment on, I settled down into, because I knew what was going to happen next, I felt somehow safe. I mean, look, this is my fifth war. So I had been through much scarier times than anything that happened to me in Dahran or even in the desert.
Gee, you know, it must have been a little like one of those lifeboat-type movies. You know, a lot of people alone together on a life raft, a great psychological drama. Here you were with all these reporters, who, some of whom you probably knew very well, some of whom you probably didn't know at all, and everybody was thinking that they were facing possible death. It must have really been some psychological...
Yeah, there was a lot of hand-holding, I have to say. A lot of hand-holding downstairs. But then you were also in your own private space, because being in that gas mask, you really couldn't talk.
Right.
So I could see them, and as I said, there was a lot of hand-holding, but we really didn't say much to each other.
NPR's Deborah Amos. Tomorrow, in part two of our conversation, we'll talk about what it's like to be a woman journalist in the Middle East. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from Yugoslavia?
We have a report from Tom Jelton, Terry. As you know, Tom Jelton and Sylvia Poggioli are both in Yugoslavia covering the story for us. This report from Tom on whether the truce, which is looking very fragile, will hold. We also have a piece from South America on the Shining Path guerrillas extending their control over Peru. The Bank of Credit and Commerce scandal has spread from the United States to Europe and now to Asia. And we're also going to anticipate the eclipse and look at eclipse fever in Hawaii.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you follow John Sayles movies, like The Return of the Secaucus 7, The Brother from Another Planet, Mate One, and Eight Men Out, you may be interested in hearing about his new novel. Sayles wrote fiction before he became a screenwriter and director. His new book, Los Gusanos, is his first novel in several years. Critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
I hate to say anything bad about John Sayles. There are too few like him out there. Sayles always tries to move his films, novels, and short stories beyond purely personal themes. Even his hack work has a political edge. In his lean years, Sayles was a rewrite man for grade B horror movies. He managed to put a Marxist spin even on something like Roger Corman's movie, Piranha. It's about a carnivorous fish that eats its way through various socioeconomic classes. I think his monster movie work kept Sayles from taking himself too seriously, which is a danger for any political artist. Even when he's dealt with grim subjects like union busting and racism, he's hardly ever been preachy. And his short story, At the Anarchists' Convention, is one of the funniest things I've ever read. Well, Los Gusanos can't be avoided any longer. Sayles told an interviewer last year that Los Gusanos had been trailing after him like a tin can on a string since 1979. You'd think that somebody might have told Sayles that this tin can of a novel belonged in the trash compactor, or at least convinced him to recycle it into something more polished. But instead, Sayles negotiated an agreement with his publisher stipulating that his novel would appear without any major editing changes. Too bad, because sometimes a good editor is just what a writer needs. The early draft of Thomas Wolfe's masterpiece, Look Homeward, Angel, was a swamp of free-floating images until editor Maxwell Perkins drained off the ooze. Los Gusanos does have some comic passages and eloquent insights into the bravery of ordinary people. But these moments lie buried 6 fathoms deep under a flat and murky narrative. The novel is set in Miami in 1981, but it also hops back and forth over 60 years in the life of a Cuban family. Scipio de la Peña, once the stern patriarch, is now a helpless stroke victim. His son Blas is a drug dealer. His other son Ambrosio was killed during the Bay of Pigs. Daughter Marta is a dreary Joan of Arc figure who believes that her divine mission is to free Cuba. She assembles a ragtag invasion force consisting of a defrocked priest, a hospital orderly, and her elderly uncle Felix. This amateur intriguing could be amusing, but it turns out to be tedious, partly because we know how this invasion will end. Even more deadly is Sale's gimmick of making almost all the characters speak in a mixture of Spanish and English, Spanglish. It makes everybody sound like Charo. Sale's great gift is his ability to create distinct personalities through dialogue, so why he would want to steamroller his characters this way is beyond me. Never before has Sale sacrificed his portrayal of gritty, everyday life to his concern for larger historical issues. But here, the characters are just walking propaganda posters. At the very least, Los Gusanos needed a few funny, politically conscious piranhas to stir things up.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Los Gusanos by John Sayles. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audie Voblaitis, Ron Barron, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Oscar Arias was president of Costa Rica, he accomplished what most people said was impossible. He got the heads of the 5 Central American countries to sign a peace agreement. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Arias about his continuing efforts for peace in the region. Also, we continue the conversation with NPR's Deborah Amos. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.